Hello, I'm Kai Nagata. This is number 0115, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0115. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet William D. Chalmers, who is the event director of the Global Scavenger Hunt.
23 days between April 13th and the 5th of May, we'll travel around the world visiting at least 10 countries. We're usually in each destination between 48 and 72 hours. Enough for them to get into trouble and do lots of scavenges and really try to test their travel IQ doing sight-doing scavenges.
Dr. Robin Odegaard is the author of Stop the Drama. Now, we tend to pick up bad habits from shows like Real Housewives and Jersey Shore, but are these shows the source of bad habits, or are they merely mimicking them?
Well, I think that definitely the people that are on the shows already have the bad habits, but I think seeing them on TV is making them much more okay and more allowed in the regular public.
Stuart Nullman is back with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman, and this time Book Banter looks back at the evolution of everyone's favorite troublemaker, Michael Moore, with his new book, Here Comes Trouble, along with what else to include for your ultimate Michael Moore library. So watch out, big business. It's all happening shortly on the Stuff File program.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0115, is Kai Nagata, who's a freelance reporter. And you can check out his blog at kainagata.com. And you'll find the link to Kai's website by going to thestufffile.com. Go to the What's On page for this show and you'll find it right there. And thank you once again, Kai, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, seems like family radio founder and pontificating wingnut Harold Camping can't quit talking when it comes to making ridiculous predictions about the end of the world. But now that we'd like to hear from him, he's not saying a word. Much to the media and to the public's disappointment, Camping has not made a statement regarding his latest October 21st failed doomsday prophecy. Family Radio made a reference expressing disappointment regarding the non-event, but mostly encouraged listeners not to lose hope and to keep sending in their donations, because as you know, there's a sucker born every minute. The broadcast ended with a suggestion that Family Radio might be undergoing some financial trouble soon. Can't be soon enough. Camping got major press during the spring regarding his May 21st end-of-the-world prediction, causing many of his followers to spend all of their savings on an advertising campaign reportedly costing several million dollars. And yet, we're all still here. When the day came and went without incident, Camping blamed a math miscalculation and revised the date to the recent one of Friday, October 21st. And yet, we're all still here. As that didn't happen, the world's worst Bible interpreter is now refusing to speak to the press. Whether Camping will try for yet another doomsday prediction is unknown, but many acknowledge he has lost a lot of confidence within his flock and certainly with the public. What I would like to know is, when exactly did he have the public's confidence? I don't remember that date, but then again, there you go. And another thing, Family Radio expressed disappointment that the world didn't end on October 21st. That's what they were actually looking forward to. Talk about being a Debbie Downer. Yikes. Anyway, moving right along, how many of us have fantasized about having a big lighted message board on our cars so that we can type out what we're really thinking about the other drivers who annoy us? Well, now you can. An enterprising young man named Gagandeep Singh has created a 40-inch by 16-inch LED matrix display and affixed it to his car's rear window. Now, using a microcontroller, he can display hard-coded messages and animations to reprimand drivers following too close behind or guilty of other driving infractions. Eventually, Singh hopes to run his display board via a mobile phone over Bluetooth, enabling him to deliver real-time updates and, we assume, insults to his fellow drivers. Okay, I'll say it right now. You know how this is going to end, don't you? Some idiot will do something stupid on the road. Young Mr. Singh will flash some sort of message on his little board. The other driver will go ballistic and do something even more idiotic. And we'll be here to tell you of yet another sad case of road rage. It's all very predictable. Really, it is. Wait for it. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, imagine you're sitting in a plane waiting for takeoff when you notice the ground crew making a repair on the pilot's window with duct tape. It happened on a flight from Ireland's Ryanair Airlines with 200 passengers on board. And guess what? The plane had to turn back after the duct tape came loose. Now, passengers watched in horror as ground crew put the tape around the edge of the windscreen shortly before taking off from Stansted, Essex. The Irish Aviation Authority said the tape had been used as an extra precaution to secure a new window seal, but the pilot aborted the flight after 20 minutes when the tape started to become loose and made disturbing noises. Ryanair insists it followed normal procedures and there was no danger to passengers or crew. However, passenger Anthony Neal said, "We were kept in the dark and were terrified. I could see guys taping in the windscreen with what looked like duct tape." Former pilot John Guntrip said, "This could have been disastrous. The pilot could have been sucked out midair if the window had come off." You know, some people have always said that there isn't anything you can't fix with duct tape. Well, I think this story brings to light the second thing you can't do with duct tape. The first thing you can't fix with duct tape? Condoms. Don't ask me how I know. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? William D. Chalmers is event director for the Global Scavenger Hunt. It's an annual travel adventure that involves 25 two-person teams who will follow cryptic clues that will take them to exotic locales around the world. William joins us on the line right now via Skype-to-Skype communications from California. Hi, William.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Oh, just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. Well, this is an adventure that started, what, way back in 2000? So this
Yes, we started this this crazy madcap around the world thing in the year 2000, and our first get out was supposed to be for October 2001. Bad timing.
Wow. Yeah, I guess so, considering history. But you've still managed to pull through, and you've done this for years now. So under the headline of, because I just described basically what it is, under the headline of "If I knew then what I know now," what's different? How has it evolved?
What's different? Well, originally, if you remember, Peter, way back when we talked, I think for the first time, way back in 2001 or 2002, we offered prize money. And after the first couple times of doing that, we decided that we'd rather kick ourselves in the head than give prize money, because it really creates a type of psychological competitiveness in people that we really didn't like.
So how do you entice people to take part if there's no prize money? Or is it just truly the adventure-seeking traveler that you're after?
No, there is something at stake. There's two things at stake. The first thing that's at stake is the title of the world's greatest travelers. And there are more than enough type A personalities out there that want to have the title on their mantle and have the trophy and the crown and the tiara of the world's greatest travelers. The teams that do win do get to come back the next year and participate and defend their title for free. So it is worth at least $20,000 for them to come and participate and do well. And so we've decided that that's the motivating factor rather than the actual cash.
Okay, so let's talk about the cost, because you did mention that returning champions get to participate for free. So if somebody wants to involve themselves in this, what exactly will it cost them to take part?
It costs $9,900 American to enter, and that includes 23 days around the world, includes all your international airfare, 23 nights in some great hotels that we stay in around the world, and about 40% of your meals. But I don't want anybody to think that this is a tour in any way. It's really for independent travelers, because once we get to a destination, it will be up to them to figure out the clues and the scavenges and do it on their own. There are days, 3 or 4 days in a row, where no one will see you. And so it really is independent travelers, not people that are looking for a package tour.
And we should mention it's a team, so that's 9,900 per person, correct?
That's correct.
Yes. Okay. So how long does this scavenger hunt, how long does this travel normally take? You start when and hopefully end when?
Sure. Our eighth event is going to take place next spring in April. It's going to begin on April the 13th, and we will be finished on May the 5th, 2012. So for the next 23 days between April 13th and the 5th of May, we'll travel around the world visiting at least 10 countries, doing scavenges in those countries. We're usually in each destination between 48 and 72 hours, enough for them to get into trouble and do lots of scavenges and really try to test their travel IQ doing sight-doing scavenges.
Okay, now, since you mentioned 10 countries, I should also mention, at least looking at your press release, it's 10 secret locations. So obviously you're not telling us where you're going to be going. So to give people an idea, let's look at last year. What happened on last year's trip, and how did people follow through on the scavenger hunt?
Well, I will tell you, as you've noticed over the years chatting with me, it is a giant jigsaw puzzle putting this event together. We do have to watch global affairs and making sure that the issues that take place in the world, and last year was a very fluid year. We had three countries on our original schedule last year, Japan, Bahrain, and Libya. That had to be taken off the list near booking time because of the events of the world, the tsunami and the earthquake in Japan, the Arab Spring uprising in Bahrain, as well as Libya. But last year we did go to Korea, Philippines, Indonesia. We got to spend 3 days in Bali, which was kind of nice. We were in Singapore, we were in India, Turkey, Spain, Portugal, and Morocco.
Now, the people who are involved in this scavenger hunt, do they themselves come from all over the world, or is it primarily North Americans, or what?
It is primarily North Americans because of the logistics, but we have had teams from England, Belgium, Germany, France, Australia, many from Canada. About 20% of our clients and participants are from Canada and Dubai.
How big has this become over the years?
You know, we limit it to 25 teams of two, so we keep it to 50 travelers. So we don't want it to get any further bigger than that. We've watched the dynamic, the psychological dynamic, the competitiveness. That's as big as it's going to get. I've been asked to do this with a private plane where we would be able to take this plane and go around the world and be able to literally go anywhere we wanted to. And the scale would have to be twice as large, and I'm just not interested in doing that. I want to keep it a real, true competition. We do vet people. We interview everyone who participates to make sure that they have their travel bona fides in order. They have been around the block, you know, at least once, been to some interesting places, are independent travelers, and are curious and game for the adventure itself.
Now, when I mean how big can it get, I know you limit the teams to 25 teams with two people per team. I'm just talking about the interest and the popularity of your event. I mean, I wasn't very familiar with it when I first started talking to you, but here we are a decade later, and I see more about it online. Is it getting more buzz? Are you getting more people who are interested?
It is getting more buzz. I think, to be frank and to be honest, you know, 2008, when the economy started to change and shift beneath us, things did change. I think that's probably been our apex. Media impressions, we probably averaged 25 million to 30 million a year, if that means anything to you. And that's not a bad thing.
Right. Now, for those who still haven't grasped the concept of what it is you're doing, let's compare it to something that is very popular and on television. I'm sure, I know we discussed this in the past, there's shows like The Amazing Race.
We're not going to talk about American Idol, are we?
No. there are shows like Amazing Race.
Ah, yes, I've heard of that.
How different is what you do from what we see on that show on TV?
How different are we from Amazing Race? Well, the first thing was we don't script what the events that they have to do. It's pretty much ad hoc, and they do what they do. We don't induce drama among our participants, and so that's not done. We don't edit what they do and what they don't do. In effect, it's not a television show. It's okay. Not made for TV. We don't kick people off for being bad or for not doing things or being successful. We don't make fun of the places that we go to. We are really, truly a cultural immersion. They really do have to trust strangers in strange lands. Sometimes they have to figure out how to, like one of my favorite scavenges is I ask people to find someone in a market and talk to them at length and see if you can't, over the course of your conversation, get invited to their home for dinner.
Wow.
And for some people, it's the most remarkable thing they've ever done. When you're in Sri Lanka in a rural village, or in India, or in Kenya, it's a remarkable thing for people who are living in Toronto or Montreal or New York or LA to go sit on a dirt floor and have a very gracious, wonderful dinner from someone, and to see how that is. So it's very different than The Amazing Race. On the flip side of it is a travel adventure competition, like it is. And there are winners and there are losers. And some people are good at playing the game and some people are not.
Well, judging by how you just described some of the things people might get a chance to do when they're on the trip, I was about to say that although somebody does win, there probably really aren't any losers in this.
No, it has been said that it's life-changing. And, you know, doing this over a decade, it is very gratifying to hear these terms. We do exit interviews with everyone prior to leaving the event. And, I would be really, truly, and honestly hard-pressed to find an individual that didn't have an extraordinary time, a life-changing time. We are now at a point now where we're at 20% repeat business, which is phenomenal when you consider that I think you've heard me say that it's a once in a lifetime adventure. But now for people, 20% of our competitors, it's not. It's an annual event.
Do the teams ever come in contact with each other or work with each other along the route?
Yes, we encourage the folks to participate with each other and to be kind with each other. They do run into each other, have dinner. Sometimes they're on the same public transportation trying to do a scavenge, or maybe they cross paths, they're going and they're coming, kind of a thing. Working with other teams is verboten, but we don't allow that, but we do allow them to have time to exchange. And because it's a rally, not a race, every time we close down to move to the next destination, everybody gets to meet each other, and there's a glow and excitement when everybody shows up at their stop point where they have to hand in their sheet of paper of completed tasks and did you do this and how'd you do that, did you meet that guy, did you find this, and it's a real exciting thing. I live vicariously through that. Personally, I'd love to participate in it, as you've heard me mention before, but I live vicariously through the examples and through the adventure stories of our travelers.
So for those who think this is something that is definitely for them, how do they go about taking part? What do they need to know? I know the website is globalscavengerhunt.com, but what do people need to do to apply?
They just need to contact us. Let us know that you're interested. There's an application process. We do interview everybody that files an application. We do want to make sure we have a good cocktail, a good mix of travelers that go with us. We've had people from 13 to 76 participate. And it's just contact us and we'll go from there. We're very mom and pop.
Again, the website is globalscavengerhunt.com. It's the Global Scavenger Hunt 2011. William, I thank you very much for being on the program with us.
Thank you, Peter, and I look forward to chatting with you again.
William D. Chalmers, event manager for the Global Scavenger Hunt. You can find out more information by going to their website at www.globalscavengerhunt.com. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0115, and you'll find links to the Global Scavenger Hunt.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander's show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio for now and forever, unless the Mayans were right.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to Dr. Robin Odegaard, the author of Stop the Trauma. Plus, we have another edition of Book Banter with Stuart Nullman. And, of course, there is indeed an idiot of the day. But right now, for your listening pleasure, more Stuff File news before we get to our next guest. 22-year-old Liam Warriner has been arrested in Australia after he mooned Queen Elizabeth during her royal visit to Brisbane. Warriner proudly showed the Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh his backside, his bare backside, complete with an Australian flag wedged between his buttocks, while running for 50 yards beside the motorcade. He claims both royals waved at him during his run. So what was the motivation? Warriner said he did it on a dare. Of course he did. Talking to reporters from the Herald Sun, he added, "I moon the Queen. Everybody's seen someone's butt. Come on. You see it on TV all the time. You see it in movies. It's accepted in PG-rated programming these days. But yet it's an offense to the Queen?" He's been charged with willful exposure and public nuisance. And Liam, there are a lot of things you can see on TV that you can't do to the Queen. The list is long. Now at least you know mooning is one of them. Okay, so what's the worst thing that could happen to a truck driver transporting 25 million bees from South Dakota to California? Well, if you listen to this program often enough, you know we like our truck spills. So guess what? Yes, it overturned. The bees were being sent from 80 honey farms to pollinate an almond crop in California, but all 25 million escaped, and Interstate 15 in Utah was closed for several hours while local beekeepers worked overnight to recapture the insects. Driver Lewis Holst and his wife Tammy had to be dragged out of the overturned big rig by rescuers and were swarmed by the escaped bees. Holst said he was stung about a dozen times and suffered a gash to his forehead. His wife also was both stung and bruised. Reportedly, Holst lost control of the vehicle, hit the concrete barrier, and rolled over. Richard 80, the owner of 80 Honey Farm, said the truckload, worth approximately $116,000, was pretty much a complete loss. And in case you're curious, we did the math. That's about half a cent per bee. Bees, two for a penny. Still America's greatest bargain when you think about it. Yes. Moving right along, a quick side note from Houston's annual Caesar Salad competition that was held at the Four Seasons Hotel. While the competition focuses on what makes the best Caesar salad, there have been other foods to try in years past, like the forgetful Caesar Salad Sorbet and last year's puzzling Caesar Salad Cupcakes.
But this year topped them all. Caesar salad cotton candy. I'm not kidding. The bright pink spun candy was flocked with shreds of Parmesan cheese and flecks of black pepper, all wrapped around a heart of romaine lettuce as its handle. Yet the judges say they were stunned by how good it tasted. That is to say, it tasted nothing like cotton candy and every bit like a Caesar salad. All I'm saying is, what really is the point? And I'm moving on. In Vallejo, California, a 21-year-old man was left hanging on a playground swing set overnight, tragically stuck in a child's bucket swing. It seems our friend had made a $100 bet with other friends that he could fit in the swing. Using liquid laundry detergent as lubricant, he managed to slide his legs into the seat, but getting out proved to be another matter entirely. After it became evident he was hopelessly stuck, his friends took off. Nice friends, huh? Anyway, the poor guy was left hanging there for 9 hours until a groundskeeper heard his screams the next morning. Firefighters cut the chains off the swing and took him to the hospital, where a cast cutter was used to remove the seat. Fortunately for him, his name has not been released. Remember in grade school, there was always that one kid who you could dare into doing just about anything? That's just it. That kind of thing usually didn't last beyond grade 3, with the exception of the entire cast of Jackass. And while we're on the topic of Jackass, we have one more story before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program. In probably the most ill-conceived excuse of all time, 28-year-old Sunday Moyo of Zimbabwe claims that it was not a donkey he was having sex with, it was a woman that had turned into a donkey. Moyo insisted the animal was in fact a prostitute he met in a nightclub. He was found by patrolling police officers around 4 a.m., and his statement to the judge during his hearing was, "Your Worship, I only came to know that I was being intimate with a donkey when I got arrested. I had hired a prostitute and paid $20 for the service at downtown nightclub, and I don't know how she then became a donkey." Wow, he didn't know he was with a donkey until the cops caught him with a donkey. The woman he picked up at the bar must have been some hairy woman. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, the courtroom erupted in laughter, and the judge remanded Moyo in custody and ordered him to be examined by government psychiatrists. Yes, this is a person who definitely needs a checkup from the neck up. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program, shall we? Whether they're scripted or not, reality TV shows give us the vicarious thrill of watching other human beings acting badly, all while we sit on our couch. But as we watch the antics of The Real Housewives and the crew of the Jersey Shore, are we picking up their bad habits? Dr. Robin Odegaard believes we are. She is the founder of the Stop the Drama campaign, and Stop the Drama is also the title of her new book. Doc Robin joins us now via Skype-to-Skype communications from New Jersey. Hi, Robin.
Good morning.
Thanks for being on the program with us. So are we learning the bad habits from these television shows, or are these television shows just mirroring the bad habits that we already have?
Well, I think that definitely the people that are on the shows already have the bad habits, but I think seeing them on TV is making them much more okay and more allowed in the regular public.
You started the Stop the Drama campaign. Was there a situation for you where push came to shove where you said, this is something I need to do?
Well, I own the company Champion Performance Development, and I was doing work with college athletes. And one of the coaches came up to me and said, can you just please make them stop the drama? And I thought, oh, what a great title for a campaign. And the more I worked with college and high school athletes, the more I saw that they were just behaving really badly, and they didn't really know how to handle disagreement in any other way.
Now, when we think of stopping the drama, when we think of people behaving badly, let's be honest, I think sometimes we're thinking more of girls than guys. Would that be correct?
It's definitely what we think. We definitely think that women behave badly more often. However, men do it too. It's just that because men have a much more winner-loser mentality, once they reach a resolution, the winner gets his way, the loser shuts up. Whereas with women, it just goes around and around and around.
So at the core, what is the basis of this activity, this lifestyle, if it were?
The activity of drama?
Yeah.
There's a couple of different things. One is that it makes sense evolutionarily to engage in it, because if you think about it, way back when women were responsible for all the housekeeping and the cooking and the cleaning and the baby raising, which of course we're not anymore, right? The only way we could do that was to be able to rely on the other women in our lives to help us. So if we got into a fist fight with them, all it did was cause injury. But if we could ostracize them, then we could have more of the resources for the group for ourselves. And so it's a learned behavior for a really, really long time. And I think, unfortunately, even though we've advanced past that in our society, we aren't teaching any other skills on how to have what I call productive conflict.
Okay, well, let me look at the positives here of this in a strange kind of way. It seems to be, the way you're describing it, that women have deeper relationships with other women and can be, as far as brain power is concerned, a little more devious.
Oh, devious, and certainly, yes, absolutely. And I don't know if that's a positive thing. I think actually it's pretty negative for women to behave that way, especially, and this is my concern, that young women who are behaving this way in high school and college are taking that into the workforce, and that absolutely will not fly in the workforce.
The reason why I asked initially if media is just mirroring a situation, I go back to when I was in high school, and I went to school in the 70s, and I always thought that watching the interaction of girls in the school with each other was akin to watching Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom in some regards.
Oh, no.
It's just that no one was filming it. Now we get to see it, and it becomes part of society on a greater scale because we watch it on television. So is this something that's, to a certain degree, always been there? We just haven't focused on it as much?
I think it's definitely always been there. I think especially women have always behaved this way with the gossip and the backstabbing. Like I said before, I think TV is making it more acceptable and an okay way to behave. I mean, how many times have you seen a woman on reality TV throw her drink at someone?
True. So since it's always been that way, how do we change it? How do we stop the drama?
The first thing we need to do is start giving young women a different set of skills, a different way to handle their negative emotion, to talk about this is what I have a problem with and this is what I need to see change, which is why I developed the 7 no-fail secrets to stop the drama, and I offer them as a free download on my website, stopthedramanow.com, because if they don't have the skills, if they have no idea what to do instead of drama, how can we expect them to behave any differently?
And how do we prevent this earlier? And by that I mean, is there something we're doing wrong as parents when raising children? Because I tend to believe that most of our attitudes are things that are learned, not something that's inherent, or am I wrong?
No, I absolutely agree with you, Peter. I call it the individual communication fingerprint, and that is developed by your interaction with your parents. And what I've found is that a lot of parents like to read my book because it gives them the ability to have better communication and conflict resolution skills to model for their younger children. Obviously, the book isn't written for children that are 8, 9 years old, but their parents can read it and then use those skills, and the children pick up on them.
Now, as I said earlier, we tend to think about girls in this regard, but going back to the parenting situation, someone reading your book, would that be just as helpful for them in raising their boys as it is raising their girls?
Yes, absolutely. Because while I think the way that boys and or men communicate is working, I don't think it's as successful as it could be. And so any edge you can give your child, male or female, is going to help them be successful. As you know, any edge, tiny as it may be, can be the difference between winning and losing when it comes to the game of life.
Now, I mentioned in the introduction shows like The Real Housewives and also The Jersey Shore. To be perfectly honest, I can't stomach this kind of programming. Your thoughts on these shows, are these things that should even be on TV? Is this the kind of thing that should be entertainment?
You know, I really hate to say that we should start censoring what people are allowed to watch. I feel like if people want to watch it as entertainment, I'm not going to say, oh no, we should take it off the TV. I really wish that we were giving, especially young people, another option, because right now the only thing they're seeing, the only thing they're getting is this, the drama and the gossip and the backstabbing and the catty behavior. And what I'm trying to do is to tell parents, look, if you can just take one idea from my book and give it to your child, one thing that they can use once a day, if they use it for the rest of their life, it'll make a difference in over 18,000 conversations. And if that's not worth the investment in a book, I don't know what is.
Absolutely. Now, have you started, because you have this campaign, you work with groups, have you started seeing a positive change?
Yes, absolutely, I have. I get emails from young women that I've worked with on a regular basis who say, hey, I taught your skills to my boyfriend and now we have a much better relationship. Or I taught those skills to my brother and my mom, and now when they argue, they don't scream. They actually have a conversation rather than a confrontation.
The book is called Stop the Drama, and that is also the name of the campaign. What will people find when they go to your website?
Well, when they go to the website, they can, like I said, there's a few different downloads they can get that are for free. They can order the book there. They will also find information about me and why the campaign is going. I have the video of the campaign that I created. So there's lots of interesting stuff. There's also a blog that I write where I talk about the different stories of drama that I hear from people, which is kind of interesting. People like to comment on the blog.
As someone who is a doctor, and again, I go back to some of those reality shows, some which take place in your own backyard, as it were.
That's true.
If you had the opportunity to talk to some of the people, to counsel some of the people who are on these shows, what would be the first thing you tell them?
Well, the first thing I would tell them is that I recognize that they're making a lot of money doing what they're doing, so they don't have a lot of motivation to change right now. But at some point, that kind of behavior is probably going to stop paying the bills, and they're going to have a set of skills that are going to be successful. And they need a different way to interact with human beings, unless, of course, they decide to take a vow of silence and become a monk on a mountain somewhere. But I think that if they could use better skills, that in the future they'll be more successful.
Again, the book is called Stop the Drama, and that is also the campaign, the Stop the Drama campaign, which Doc Robin is the founder of. Dr. Robin Odegaard, I thank you very, very much for being on the program with us.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me. And please have your listeners go to stopthedramanow.com to learn more.
Dr. Robin Odegaard, founder of the Stop the Drama campaign. Stop the Drama is also, as I mentioned, the title of her book. And you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0115, and you'll find links to Robin's website, which is stopthedramanow.com. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. I just learned about a great organization that helps gifted young musicians get started in the music world. Even the most talented musicians can have a hard time becoming a professional, so this nonprofit group was formed to give youngsters a head start. Unfortunately, I heard about the group, called Young Concert Artists, because they were sued by a professional musician who's 60 years old. Martin Stoner wants to compete for a prize that this private group set aside for 16 to 26-year-olds, so he's suing, claiming age discrimination. Let's be fair, age discrimination is serious. But Mr. Stoner has more than 25 years of concert experience, and he shouldn't be allowed to use the courts to take opportunities away from youngsters. This lawsuit hits a real sour note, but there's even more. Stoner now wants the judge assigned to his case to be removed, saying that the judge, who's 88, is too old. Talk about double standards. Find out more. Go to our website at centerforamerica.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And once again, Stuart Nolman is here with us with Book Banter. Hi, Stu.
Yeah, hi, Peter. I'm out for trout today.
Out for trout? What do you mean by that?
Well, have you ever seen Roger and Me?
Yes, okay. You're talking about Michael Moore's film.
That's right. And that was a slogan on his baseball cap. He's out for trout. So when you think of Michael Moore, listen, we read his latest book. When you finish it, it's called Here Comes Trouble. The general impression that you get about this Academy Award-winning filmmaker is that he was born to cause trouble, but for all the right reasons. For over 30 years, from his home base of Flint, Michigan, Michael Moore has used the printed page and the movie camera in the old journalistic muckraker tradition that thrived throughout the 19th and 20th centuries, and became an agent provocateur, not only for the people of his hometown, but also those average American people who have been downtrodden by the arrogance and indifference of big business and big government. And if you want to find out why Michael Moore has that muckraker people's champion in his blood and the events that led to it, then Here Comes Trouble tells it all in a book that is just as captivating as one of his award-winning feature documentaries. But this is not your average structured autobiography. It's a collection of 24 autobiographical stories that deal with Moore's early life as a crusader through 1989, when Roger and Me was about to debut at the Telluride Film Festival. But the book begins with the story that pretty well defined Michael Moore as a major league filmmaker and troublemaker. It was on stage at the 2002 Academy Awards ceremony when he won the Oscar for Best Documentary for Bowling for Columbine and delivered his most controversial acceptance speech when he called George W. Bush a fictitious president. And for the first time, Moore gives the reader a behind-the-scenes glimpse of what happened immediately after he left the stage, as well as the repercussions that this little incident affected him and his family. The rest of the book's stories are just as revealing and entertaining. We learn about his first encounter with a major American politician, which was at the age of 11 in 1965. When he accidentally met Senator Robert Kennedy in the Capitol building in Washington, he was lost, and the senator helped him find his parents. You find about his first foray into public office as the youngest commissioner at age 19 in the Davison, Michigan Board of Education, and how he made Roger and Me with virtually no money, and how he practically harassed prominent film critic Roger Ebert to attend the film's premiere at Telluride, when Ebert had tickets to attend the gala screening of the festival's opening film, which was happening at the same time. So Here Comes Trouble could also be called the evolution of Michael Moore. We finally get the roots of why he has waged a constant battle against the injustices that the average hardworking American citizen had to endure against greed and indifference, because he's personally experienced and witnessed it within the framework of his beloved Michigan in general, and Flint in particular. This is the story of an average Joe who enjoys his role as a crusader for the people and uses the mass media as his big stick for plenty of cause and effect. And believe me, when the sequel comes out, I can hardly wait for it. I think there will be a sequel to Here Comes Trouble.
You do?
Yeah. Well, he has to, you know, tell the story of what happens after Roger and Me debuts. That's where he left. That's where he leaves the book off.
So volume two coming soon to a bookstore near you, I guess?
Well, I hope so, but he's still promoting Here Comes Trouble. And also, if you like Michael Moore, don't forget to read his big bestseller, Stupid White Men, his first book, Downsize This, which is almost like book versions of his films. And of course, you got to see Roger and Me, the one that started it all, because, you know, he's out for trout, and Roger Smith in particular.
Any other books by troublemakers that you've been a fan of besides Michael Moore's books?
Well, you know what? I used to study journalism a lot. So when journalism school also, we were made to read some, you know, books by, you know, veteran journalists. And one of my favorites was the autobiography of Lincoln Stevens, who was the first muckraker, actually. He, you know, exposed corruption within the robber barons of the 19th century. So, and I think it's standard text for any, if you're going to be a future Mike Wallace or Michael Moore, read the autobiography of Lincoln Stevens. It's really some very down-to-earth stuff about what, you know, what it was like to be a crusading journalist, especially in those early days of print journalism.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, because we talk about Michael Moore as being a filmmaker, a director. We talk about him as being a troublemaker. Do we actually ever really call him a journalist?
Well, I wouldn't say he didn't study journalism per se, but he did have it. But he did, you know, have his own magazine, The Michigan Voice. So in a way, he was a journalist without having the training for it. So he did have the experience in it, but not many people know about it. But you'll find out when you read the book.
Okay. So, and the book again is
called Here Comes Trouble by Michael Moore, published by Grand Central Publishing, and it's $29.99.
And how can people find you, sir?
Well, you can find me in the pages of the West End Times, or, you know, in paper, or online at www.westendtimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
You're welcome, Peter.
Stuart Nolman with another edition of Book Banter here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holden.
The Stuff File.
And we have a few more Stuff File stories before we get to this week's Idiot of the Day. A rumor that prestigious Smith College was going entirely vegetarian had a lot of students asking, where's the beef? The rumor was that the all-women's college would only buy and serve food from local growers, which resulted in protests from the carnivores and counter-protests by the vegans at the Massachusetts campus. It turns out it was all just a rumor cooked up by two professors as part of their introductory class in logic. Professor Jay Garfield said the prank was a way to liven up a dry topic. He and Professor Jim Henley have apparently started false rumors in the past. Smith President Carol Crist got in on the fun, releasing a statement that Garfield and Henley had both been fired over the prank. That, too, was a hoax. And speaking as someone who once got fired for a practical joke, I like their style. Meanwhile, while sex offenders are certainly never a laughing matter, it's hard not to at least snicker at 57-year-old Charlie J. Price of Pittsfield, Massachusetts. Price, a convicted sex offender, had been cited for disturbing the peace after admitting to kissing and fondling a cardboard cutout of a woman, which was part of an advertising display for Rite Aid. Price, who was allegedly intoxicated at the time, walked into the Rite Aid pharmacy and grabbed hold of the sunglass display, hugged it tightly, and then began to lick and kiss the face of the female cutout. This went on for about a minute until he fell on the floor. Not surprisingly, the behavior scared other customers who enthusiastically ran from the store. Police arrived and arrested Price, who is a level 3 sex offender and therefore considered to be at a high risk to reoffend. High risk? You figure? He was making out with cardboard. Yeah. Meanwhile, Dallas police said they were searching for a man accused of striking a woman twice with a frozen armadillo while negotiating about a price for the carcass. Police said the man was attempting to sell the frozen armadillo to a 57-year-old woman in an apartment complex parking lot on September 29th, but the pair argued about the price of the animal, which the woman planned to cook and eat. The man threw the armadillo at the woman twice, causing bruises to her leg and chest. Investigators said the man could face assault charges if he is identified. Now, that's something different when you think about it, huh? Being beaten by meat? Yeah, slight twist there. California police, responding to reports of someone screaming for help, discovered a man stuck inside a hollow trunk of a standing tree. The man, whose name was not released, had crawled into the hole in the trunk, leading to a cavity about 4 or 5 feet underground in Laguna Hills. Battalion Chief Chris Concepcion of the Orange County Fire Authority said only the man's head and arms were visible, and it took 90 minutes to retrieve the equipment necessary to cut him free. Firefighters were called to the scene to check the man's mental health. Why he's in a tree, I have no idea, Concepcion said. It is unknown how long the man was actually stuck in the tree, and he was freed without suffering any injuries. Why did he climb in the tree? I don't know. Maybe he thought he was a Keebler elf and wanted to make cookies. And elsewhere in the Stuff File news, a woman driving on U.S. Highway 71 in Kansas City, Missouri, saw a man dancing in the roadway, which had caused traffic to screech to a halt. The man came over to her car, jumped on the hood, pointed a gun at her, and yelled, "Drive!" She did just that, straight to the headquarters of the Kansas City Police, about 2.5 miles away. When she arrived, the door to the police garage was down. That didn't stop her. It took 3 tries to ram through the door, with the man still holding on to her car's hood, while an attendant inside yelled for help over his radio. Once the car broke through the door, which completely destroyed it, the carjacker, who had apparently lost his gun, ran out to board a city bus to escape, but officers arrived and arrested Dionette L. Price, age 26. A police spokesman had just one thing to say about the incident: very effective. Now, it wasn't quite effective enough if he could still run away, as far as I'm concerned. And by the way, for me, driving 70 miles per hour, then slamming on the brakes and sharply turning would get anything off my hood that I didn't want there. That's all I'm saying. And moving right along, in Stamford, Connecticut, 18-year-old Luis Perez's mother had had enough of him. He refuses to clean his room, he's disrespectful and swears at her, so she called the police, and they arrested him. Now, being the big bad man that he is, Luis was stupid enough to challenge officers' authority and refuse to put his pants on. According to Sergeant Simon Blanc, the mother told police she leaves her home clean and orderly before her 12-hour day as a nanny. The home is a mess when she returns, and Luis Perez invites other people whom she doesn't know. When she complained, he swore at her, and when she threatened to call police, Perez swore some more and said he did not care. Police were escorted to his room, where they discovered Perez under blankets without pants, talking on a cell phone. When asked to go downstairs to talk to his mother, Perez said he was not coming out and that police were invading his privacy. He also said the police were breaking the law by coming into his room and he wouldn't put his pants on. Bad move. However, he lost some of his macho badness after being handcuffed and taken outside, where he begged police for a second chance to be released. They said no. You know, Thanksgiving should be really fun at their house. Don't you think? Yeah. I almost made him the idiot of the day, because he really is an idiot, but I didn't. He wasn't this week's idiot of the day. But we now have this week's idiot of the day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff I present, the idiot of the day.
This one's short and sweet. One would think the robber of a gas station would consider filling the tank before fleeing. However, Moses Gift, age 47, was arrested in September in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and charged with robbing the Huff Shell station shortly before running out of gas a short distance away. Not that I want to encourage crime, but you know, fill the tank, rob the store. That's the order you gotta kind of do it in. Fill the tank, rob the store. Why would someone do it the other way around? Or at least not even fill the tank at all? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0115. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. And at the website, you'll find information on links and all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, that's 0115. You can email me at peter@thestufffile.com, and you can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags and mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, aboard China Airlines, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. While it may be an enjoyable, pleasant experience, some side effects may occur. Listening to Peter may cause bloating, drowsiness, Tourette's, web feet, or an oily discharge.